we're back now with Simon Estes, who is the greatest opera singer to come from Iowa. He's a pioneer of civil rights, a great humanitarian, philanthropist, educator. As a singer, he has sung lead roles, over 100 of them, with all the greatest opera houses in the world, a total of 89 of them, with all the greatest orchestras, 115, and with all the great conductors, 90 of them. He broke many color barriers. He was the first black man to sing at the Bayreuth Festival. He starred there for 6 seasons. He has sung for kings and queens, Nobel laureates, 6 presidents in the White House, and the only man to have sung at both the 25th and 50th anniversaries of the United Nations. Dr. Estes has taught at Juilliard, but now is a distinguished professor and artist in residence at Wartburg College and the F. Wendell Miller Distinguished Artist in Residence at Iowa State. And here in Iowa, the Riverfront Amphitheater in Des Moines, very popular venue, is named for him, as is a high school in Cape Town, South Africa. Their chorus has sung in our state. It's been honored with the highest awards from our state and elsewhere. So it's a great honor for us here at Iowa Public Radio to have Simon Estes join us. Dr. Estes, thanks so much for coming in.
I'm delighted to be here and to be on your show. Thank you.
I was going to ask you about your life and your story. And you were born in Centerville, 1938, our state's
right.
Missouri border. But I'd like to start a little earlier with your grandparents and your parents, all just remarkable figures to read about.
My grandfather and grandmother on my father's side, of course, my grandfather on that side, his name was Major Estes. He was a slave, sold for $500, and obviously his wife was a slave also, and her name was Rachel. And my father had several sisters and brothers, of course, and of course, my grandfather on my father's side was born in the early 1820s. Late 1820s. And on my mother's side, my mother was born in Centerville. My father was born in Virginia, then came to Iowa because of the coal mines. And I don't know, at that time, I don't think we really had slavery in Iowa when my grandparents were born on my mother's side. But, you know, they very well could have been because they had to have been born about that same time before the Emancipation Proclamation. But I grew up in Centerville. My father only had a third grade education because he was taken out of, they were called readers in those days, at like the third grade, the third reader, they call them readers. And he had to work on the, in quotes, farm or plantation. And my mother was born in Centerville, Iowa, in 1910. My father was born in 1891, and he came to Centerville because of the coal mines. So I grew up in Centerville. As you state, I was born in 1938. And we had some problems in Centerville because of skin color, but my parents always taught my sisters and me never to be bitter and never to hate anyone. But we were very, very poor in Centerville. My dad, I don't think he ever made more than $20 a week, and he had a family of 6. I had 3 older sisters and myself. So that's kind of a quick synopsis of the history going back to my grandfather. And I have a photo of my grandfather, my grandmother, my father's side when they were slaves.
Wow. Wow. And in Centerville, there really was the level of racism is something that I think a child growing up today might not even be able to imagine. Tell us a story about that, perhaps.
Well, I wrote my autobiography some years ago, about 14, 15 years ago, and the lady who I had helped me organize everything. I spoke into a, she was a classmate 1 year ahead of me in high school in Centerville. Her name was Mary Carpenter then. And a lot of people wanted me to do my bio, autobiography. So anyhow, I thought she would know a lot about my history. So she actually organized the book, but I gave her all the information. But there was some information that she gave to me that I didn't know about. For the longest time, we're called colored in those days. We were not allowed to swim in the swimming pools with white children,
wow.
White people in general. And eventually they would let us swim on Saturdays from 9 o'clock until 11. Then once we got out of the pool, this is what Mary Swanson Carpenter told me, that they'd put more disinfectant in the water. We couldn't sit downstairs in the movie theater with white people. That just wasn't allowed. They had a little area where we sat. They call it, incidentally, the crow's nest, where the colored people had to sit by the toilets and the projector room. You could hear those loud projectors back in those days. And we were not allowed to sit downstairs. And so one time I was going to the movie with some of my high school friends. I was the only colored graduating person in my high school graduating class also in 1956. And they were not aware that we couldn't sit downstairs. Number one, I wasn't allowed to go to the movies because of the violence of cowboy shooting and that thing. So I sneaked with my white friends, and I was getting ready to go upstairs to sit. My friend said, "Hey, Cy, where are you going?" I said, I'm going to go sit down. They said, "Come sit. Why aren't you going to sit with us?" I said, "Well, I'm not allowed to sit downstairs." And they looked very this, what are you talking about? Even back then, they were not aware of it. See, they were young people. And so anyway, to make a long story short, they convinced me to sit with him, but I was really nervous. But just as we were walking in, the manager saw me and he yelled, "Hey, Estes," he said, "where do you think you're going?" And before I had a chance to answer, my white friends, one kid, his dad was a doctor, another was owned Brown Shoe Store. They were, you know, the rich white kids, you know. And so this one boy said to Mr. Johnson, he said, "Cy is going to sit with us, and if you don't let him sit with us, I'm going to tell my old man and he'll fire you." Because, see, he was paid by the City Chamber of Commerce to manage the Majestic and the Rich Theater. So I thought, really great. You know, I was the one that broke the barrier there, too. So there was, but I don't think Center was any different than Albuquerque or Bloomfield or Cedar Falls or Waverly back in those days, or cities in Minnesota, Nebraska. It just existed at that time. But my parents always taught me never to be bitter. If I'd come home, just for example, if I told my mother a white boy hit me or called me the N-word, my mother would say, "Well, you get down on your knees and you pray for that boy." Wow. And that manifested itself when I started singing opera. Well, I'll just skip ahead because these two stories kind of go together. I'd already been singing in most of the opera houses in the early 70s. And I remember I called my mother in tears. I was in New York City, had an apartment. I said, "You know, Mother, I'm singing in Rome, Berlin, Vienna, London, all over, but they won't let me sing in the opera houses in my own country, some of the opera houses." My mother said, "Well, you get down on your knees, son, and you pray for them," because I remember what, and she remembered what she had told me when I was little. So I grew up, as so to speak, praying for my enemies or whatever. But we had a very, very happy home. We didn't have any running water, which means we didn't have an indoor toilet. And we know how cold it gets in Iowa in the winters until I was a sophomore in high school. And we didn't have central heat. We just had an old coal stove. And I was born in this really small house in Centerville, and Dr. Brummett, it's another interesting story, he delivered me in this little house when I was born, but Dr. Brummett actually breastfed as my grandmother on my father's side. She was a wet nurse for the white people. See, I don't know if you know that history.
I didn't know that. No.
What happened way back in those days, white women didn't want their breasts to get out of shape, you know, because if a baby, you know, sucks the milk, sometimes their breasts do not go back to their original nice, firm, you know, shape, etc. And so they were called wet nurses. And my grandmother actually fed Dr. Brummett, who was a white man who later became a doctor, of course, and he delivered me. And I think that's kind of an interesting circle of events.
It certainly is. Your mother is this figure of just, to me, incredible wisdom. And
yes,
her lessons to you, it must have been incredibly rewarding for her to see you rise to that level. Tell us about how it was for her. Did she get to see your triumphs on the international stage?
I'm very grateful she did. The first president I sang for was on 1966 was President Johnson, and I got the third prize in the Tchaikovsky first vocal competition. It was the first year they ever had it. And in it, I won the bronze medal, the third prize. When I came back to the United States, President Johnson invited me to White House and some other winners. And my mother was invited. My parents were both invited, but my father had already died at that time. And she was just so excited about coming and nervous. She says, "I don't know how to go. I don't know how to use the right silverware." And I explained all that to her. But she was a lady of tremendous faith and wisdom, as was my father. I grew up in a very, very spiritual home. We went to the Second Baptist Church. The white Baptist Church in Centerville, they had two, see, the white and the colored. And the white Baptist church was the first Baptist church, and the colored church was the second Baptist church, which is kind of interesting also. But we went to church two times on Sunday, and I mentioned to you earlier, we were taught never to hate white people. My mother said, when you're mistreated, you have to pray for them. I learned a lot of wisdom from my mother by conversation. My mother was a talker. My father was very, very quiet. But I learned from my father the power of example. Because he loved my mother. He never yelled at my mother. He never yelled at my sisters or me. He worked 12, 14 hours a day for menial money. But yet, he was a great example. And he was a spiritual man, too. And I am who I am today because my two first great mentors were my mother and my father.
I can see that. And your father's work, just as you tell me about him, I mean, coal mining is just backbreaking work. It's just some of the hardest labor around. And this didn't wear him down.
No, he came to Centerville because of the coal mine. Centerville, when I grew up, we had three very, very active coal mines in Centerville. And it was a small, like, cosmopolitan town, because people came with people from Germany, from London, from Sweden, from Croatia, from Africa, not voluntarily, but just people all around the world in Centerville. We had about 8,000 people then, and now Centerville has less than 6,000 people. But the coal mines is what attracted so many people to come to Centerville.
That's extraordinary. Now, there was music in your home.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
My mother had a voice, and I had an older sister named Patty. And I really believe they had better voices than I did. My mother, obviously, having been born in 1910, there was no possibility that she would ever have sung any classical music. But when she was very young, she was sent to Piney Woods, Mississippi. There was an all-colored college or high school down there way back then. And I remember my mother having told me the story. She got homesick because she came back after 2 weeks. But my mother had an incredible voice and an incredible range. She could sing first soprano, second soprano, alto. And a few years before my mother died, she was almost 95, I was in Des Moines in the apartment where she was living. I was just over there kind of vocalizing, fooling around on the piano. And I sang a low D, you know, just above low C on the piano. And my mother sang that note. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, I must be. So I played and I listened. She really did do that. She could sing a low D that I sing. And I'm probably speaking on my speaking voice right now is probably lower than a low D. It's probably around an A or a B flat or something. But my mother had this incredible range. And my oldest sister named Patty, she also had incredible voice. She ended up being a nurse, but she died very young. But my mother, we had an old upright beat up piano in our home. And with my three sisters, mother and I, my dad didn't sing with us. He didn't sing. We'd gather around the piano and sing hymns and gospels and Negro spirituals. And I grew up with just music. My older sister, Patty, also, she became a classical pianist. She graduated from Mercy Nursing School in Des Moines many years before that. She had an incredible voice and could play the piano, and she played classical music. So I was introduced to the classical instrumental music at a very young age because of my sister.
And little did they know where this would lead.
Right. I didn't know. They didn't know.
So this is the next part of the story. You go to the University of Iowa. So I understand you were planning to do pre-med or...
I was in pre-med, and then I was interested in theology and also social psychology. And Charles Kellis, who is still living, and he's teaching privately in New York. I'll see him next week when I go to New York. But he heard me singing in the old Gold Singers. And I started taking voice lessons with him, and he said, you know, you have a voice to sing opera. And having come from Centerville, I more or less said, you know, what is opera? So he loaned me some recordings of great opera singers, a famous Italian-based Cesare Siepi, and a recording of Eileen Farrell, Leontine Price, and who else? And I think it was Jerome Hines. And then he loaned me one classical recording, records, we call them those days, of Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. And I remember I listened to those old 33 1/3, and I took them back to Mr. Kellis. I said, I really like that stuff. You know, what did I know from Centerville? So that was my introduction or baptism into classical music. And then he was the one that said, Simon, first of all, I'll tell you, he worked with me privately, and I wasn't in the School of Music at that time. He'd give me voice lessons sometimes 3-4 hours a day. He really would in North Hall. I still remember this. And He saw this talent that I had that I didn't know I had. I didn't know I had that. But after 2 years having worked with Mr. Kellis, he said, you need to go to an all-musical school. He had graduated from Juilliard way back in 1950, I think it was. So he arranged an audition for me. I flew out to New York. As soon as I finished singing, I can still remember the jury and some of the teachers who were on the jury. They said, just wait outside the door. And so I went out, and I can still remember that smell of Juilliard School of Music. I was in the old Juilliard before the Lincoln Center. And they called me back in after about, you know, 5-10 minutes. They said, we'd like to give you a full scholarship to go to Juilliard School of Music. Because I was so naive, I didn't have enough sense to be nervous for the audition. I wasn't nervous. I just walked out and sang, you know, I didn't know. And so they said, we'd like to give you a full scholarship. And I said, oh, well, thank you. Just kind of like that. I mean, they probably thought this guy's nuts. Because I didn't realize at that time the magnitude of Juilliard School of Music. I was just naive.
So that the calm nerves are really the fact that you just didn't know what the stakes were.
Didn't know to be nervous.
Wow.
And I've looked back on that many times and thought maybe that was a blessing too. God gave me a gift to not be nervous.
If only we all could do that all the time. Well, so now you're studying at America's Great Music School.
Right.
The greatest teachers in the center of opera. And what happened then from there to your...
Well, to Juilliard, I was there. I went there in 1963, started in 1964, met a girlfriend there who graduated in 63 and went to Europe to audition for some managers. And I wanted to see her Christmas time, I remember, in 1964. And I'll make the long story short. But anyhow, I had no money. And I worked my way through Juilliard. Also, I worked my way through the University of Iowa. I shined shoes, cleaned toilets, scrubbed floors, did windows, you name it. I had to do everything to get through college. But anyhow, I wanted to see her Christmas in December 1964. And so I said, well, I said, can you find me someone to sing for? She said, well, this man, Friedrich Posch, is a manager working for me, meaning her, to audition opera houses. I said, because then I can go to some people maybe and see if they will help me be able to get the money to fly over there. So she did get an audition for me. And so I didn't know what to do. So I went to the NAACP in New York City. Again, I was so naive, didn't realize, I mean, me, New York was just a place with big buildings. I wasn't scared of the people, you know, didn't have enough sense to be. And so I went into the office, knocked on the door, walked in. They said, you know, we said, yes, may I help you? And so I said, I'd like to speak to, I don't remember if it was Roy Wilkins, who was the head of the NAACP at that time, or maybe like his assistant. But they said, I need to speak to somebody in a high position. I don't remember my exact terminology then. So I spoke with this person. I said, you know, I've got a chance to go to Europe to audition for some managers for opera houses. And they looked at me like I was crazy. They said, well, we don't give money out for something like that. I said, well, I'm a student at Juilliard School of Music. And they changed right away. Oh, you are? You're going to Juilliard? I said, yes. And I said, I just had this chance. To make a long story short, they didn't have funds for this, but they took up a collection of $287 in the office to help me fly to go to Germany. So I flew over at Christmas time, and they told me to. They said, go to the New York Community Trust Fund. They might be able to help you, which I did, and they did. So I went over December 24th, 1964. I will never forget, arrived Christmas morning in Dusseldorf, sang for this manager towards the end of December of that year, and he liked my voice. He said, I'd like to get you an audition after the first of the year, if you can stay for the Deutsche Oper in West Berlin. I was still a student at Juilliard. So I waited, and then I went and sang. I sang for the agent. I said he liked my voice. Then I went to the Deutsche Oper and did an audition on the stage. Had never been on an opera stage before in my life. And again, so naive, didn't have enough sense to be nervous. I just walked out and sang as though I was singing in the Centerville High School Auditorium or Second Baptist Church. And I finished singing, and Professor Zay Fellner, who was the director of the artistic aspect of the Berlin Opera House in West Berlin in those days, he said, we'd like to give you a contract to sing The King and Aida.
Wow.
And I said, okay, thank you again. But when I went back and I studied with my teacher, Mr. Kellis. But when I arrived, they told me I had to do Rhamphus. And Rhamphus is the high priest. That's a bigger role than the king in Aida. And so I called Mr. Kellis from Berlin. He said, that doesn't make sense, Simon. He said, why are they? He said, well, look, you can do it. You have 13. So I learned Rhamphus in 13 days, sang it on the stage in the Deutsche Oper in West Berlin, had never been on the stage before, didn't meet the conductor till after the performance. They didn't tell him that I was a beginner. Richard Cassily, who was a great American tenor, I don't know if you know that name, he sang opera a lot. He did the Radames, Gloria Davy, did Aida, and Ruth Hesse did Omnetics. And I had not met any of that cast until the night of the performance. So I rehearsed in a big rehearsal room with stage assistant stage directors, etc. Told me you go there and there, etc. So I did. And after that, they offered me some other roles, and that took off my career. And that was April 19th, 1965, when I made my debut with the opera house in West Berlin, the Deutsche Oper.
That's perfect story. And this thing of learning this big role in a few days.
13 days.
And I'm looking at your career with over 100 roles. You are a person who masters these really difficult roles very quickly.
You know what it was? I realized, again, that God gave me a talent to sing. I give him all the praise and glory. And I didn't know until I started singing professionally, he gave me a talent to memorize. I could memorize a whole opera in 4 or 5 days, whether it's in Russian, German, Italian, French. I just could. And I have somewhat of a photographic memory, but so much of it just came. I just studied really, really hard. I literally have memorized operas in 4 days. He gave me that gift, and I think that. And the people in Europe knew that I could learn music fast, so I was always jumping in for somebody or somebody got sick or whatever, you know. So
they knew they could count on you to have the role.
Yeah.
That is just extraordinary.
But it was a gift from God also.
And hard work and
hard work. Attitude. Oh yes, had to work hard. Yes,
you know, the intersection with the history of the 20th century. First of all, the civil rights movement, even in the 50s, as your friends are standing up for you at the theater, but then the 60s, when Roy Wilkins, the NAACP, and then you're in West Germany during the Cold War, and the next year you win a Tchaikovsky medal in Moscow, right at the height of the Cold War. Your life has had so many interesting intersections. As this was happening, was any of this, how did these things seem to you at the time?
I was not aware because I was constantly learning new repertoire. I probably sung 50 or 60 orchestral works, you know, all the Requiems and the Messiah, the Haydn Creation, the Haydn Seasons. You can go right down the list. I've sung all this music, Handel's Messiah, of course, etc. And I was so busy, I didn't realize what I had been doing. And on one hand, I'm glad that I didn't at that point. It was much later in my careers, in the mid-80s, and I started in 1965. I remember I built a new house outside of New York in New Jersey when my wife was pregnant with our first child because we'd wanted to bring them up in New York, had an apartment in New York City. And I built this house on 3 acres of land. And one evening after dinner, by that time I think we had two daughters or three daughters, because I do have three daughters now, I remember I was walking around this house and I looked at it and I thought, wow, I built that house and paid for it. It was like, it never changed my humility that my mother and my father taught me. You must always remain humble. So I never ever felt as I was a star. When I have interviews and things, people say, well, how does it feel to be a star? And I said, I'm not a star. The stars are in heaven. I'm just a human being that God blessed and gave a talent to sing. But I never, every once in a while now, I'll think about, I think, how did I memorize 102 roles? I sang with all these conductors, going back to Leonard Bernstein or Eugene Ormandy, Eric Leinsdorf, and all these conductors. And I just, when I think about it sometimes, I think, how did I do all of that? Really, that's kind of the way it is.
I can see that the humility would take some of the pressure off you in a sense. You're not thinking of yourself as being a star. You're out there doing the job.
Yeah, just doing the job. And you hit the nail on the head. My mother stressed humility. I cannot tell you how much she told me. You must always remain humble, son. And my father was a very humble man. As I say, I learned from him from the power example. My father was 1/4 American Indian also. He was a very quiet, peaceful man. And I think because of the upbringing that I grew up in a house where there was no yelling, my father, as I said, never yelled at my mother or my sisters or me. And I think all of this was preparation, when I look back on it now, of becoming this opera singer. I played football, basketball, track, baseball in high school in Centerville. Then went to the University of Iowa. I played a little bit of basketball, but not on the team, just fun. And when I started lifting weights, etc. But I didn't realize at that time, you say that, as I look back on it later, I was building up lung capacity, a breathing, because, you know, in order to speak, you got to breathe. In order to sing, you got to breathe. In order to live, you got to breathe. And so I didn't realize that that was preparing me, which I didn't know about at that time, to become an opera singer.
I see how it all comes together. Yeah. Well, you're saying by the 1970s at all the most famous houses in Europe, La Scala, Covent Garden, Bavarian State Opera, Vienna State Opera, the Salzburg Festival, Glyndebourne Festival, however you say that. But that stands out the most in the biography is 1978, the Bayreuth Festival, this sort of shrine that Wagner built for his operas. You became, you sang the title role in the opening opera, The Flying Dutchman, and became the first black male, African-American or otherwise, ever to sing there, much less in a lead role.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
I would say, because many times people say, what was the most memorable? And I don't know if I'd always call it memorable as much as the most, how would I say that? The most significant, simply because that was the mecca of Wagnerian music. I mean, that's the mecca to sing in Bayreuth. And for a black man to go there and not only to sing the title role, but a new production and opening the whole season, the whole festival. And some of the press, you know, obviously found out that I was going to be doing that, and some of the German people were not happy about it. They said, we're going to boo him off the stage. We don't want a black man singing a title role of Wagner's music in Bayreuth. But that didn't deter me at all. And I'm happy to say that I ended up not getting booed at all. But it was probably the biggest mountain or biggest hill up to that point that I had to climb, just because of the historical significance and because of Germany, because of the Second World War, you know, being against not only Jewish people, but black people, anybody that didn't have blue eyes and blonde hair. You know, you don't belong there. You're not even a real human being. And it was a tremendous amount of pressure. But the fact that I had sung the previous year, the Flying Dutchman, Zurich Opera House, in a new production there. And I remember, I'll tell you something else, that the conductor, he was a nice man. His name was Ferdinand Leitner. He didn't want me to sing it. But the director of the opera house, whose name was Dr. Helmut Klaus Dreiser, he said, "I want Simon to sing the title role." And he was the director of the opera house. And the conductor said, "No, I don't want him because I was black." But he let me, Dreiser overruled him, and I sang it. And that's when Wolfgang Wagner heard about me and invited me to Bayreuth. But the reason I still say that Bayreuth was so meaningful, and I think it's probably more meaningful, because then I realized that this man, the conductor in Zurich, didn't really want me to sing that role either. But the director of the opera house overruled him, and I did it. So this is interesting how...
Yeah, so this is different from the Juilliard audition. This time you really knew what a big deal it was.
Right.
By now you've had so much operatic experience with this role and with Wagner.
Right.
Still, I can imagine the pressure was incredible.
Well, the pressure was still there, but I can still remember when I walked out on the stage and I sang King Philip, sorry, from Don Carlo, Et la Jemimamo, and I sang the Flying Dutchman monologue from the Flying Dutchman, this big Die Fristis I sang that for them, and right away they invited me to come to the Deutsche Oper, and then I went to the Bayreuth, sang just Wagner. Then I did the Flying Dutchman's monologue and some other sections from the Flying Dutchman, and the stage director was Harry Kupfer, and Dennis Russell Davies was a conductor of this new production. He's an American conductor, and that really was the biggest catalyst probably for my career, because of the publicity that was centered around this first black man at Bayreuth, and title role, new production, opening the season. And then they did a new production about 4 years later, Parsifal, and Jimmy Levine conducted that. Gertz Friedrich did the stage direction, and I did Am Vordertas in that. So I've sung all of Wagner's operas except Die Meistersinger. I've sung 102 roles, so.
Yeah, you're really one of the few people to have sung most of the Wagner operas.
All of them except one. I didn't do Rienzi, but the main ones.
The main ones.
And
yeah.
I was offered to do Hans Sachs and Meistersinger many years before in San Diego, but I didn't do it. But I've just sung Flying Dutchman all over the world, and all of my operas. I've been very blessed.
You've had tremendous range as an artist, because in addition to the big Wagner roles, you've done so many other types of roles, and you've done quite a lot of art song. You've also, last week we, in fact, played your recording of the Four-Way Requiem with Colin Davis, you know, beautiful lyrical singing on that, very different from what I think of as Wagnerian singing. You've worked in so many different styles and different languages. Mm-hmm. I imagine that your ear probably helps you in getting those accents and all of
it
that.
It does, yes.
Did your career working with orchestras develop after opera or concurrently?
Concurrently, I would say. And what prepared me, which I didn't know, when I first started singing right after the Tchaikovsky competition, which was 66, I got with Columbia Artists Management in New York, and the first year I got with them, they got me a lot of recitals with, they had an organization within CAMI, Columbia Artists Management Incorporated, called Community Concerts, and that's where little small towns that have like four concerts, subscription concerts a year. And the first year I got with Columbia, because I couldn't get as much opera because of the racial thing, I mean, that first year I did 45 recitals throughout the United States and Canada, and I did Schubert and Brahms and Wolf. And Mahler, and of course I would always do some Negro spirituals and some Mozart concert arias. All this repertoire was preparing me for the later on the operatic career. And the reason I mention that, because I was able to sing very piano, and I could sing, you know, forte. And when I went to Bayreuth, I remember they did Flying Dutchman. I still have these critics. They said it's the first time they'd ever heard Wagnerian music sung bel canto, meaning beautiful singing, like Verdi or Bellini or Donizetti. And I think that came about because at the beginning of my career, even though it was wrong that I was discriminated against, it was probably a lifesaver for me because I didn't do too much opera at the beginning, even though I was still singing opera. But I did a lot of recitals, and I did so many oratorios. I did the Bach St. Matthew Passion, St. John Passion, Bach Magnificat, the B Minor Mass, all of the works, not all, but Haydn Creation, The Seasons. All of this work I did in addition to opera. And I continued to do recitals of Brahms' Four Serious Songs, of Mahler, Rückertlieder. All of this, I didn't realize it at the time, but I had that flexibility in my voice. I could awaken at 3 o'clock in the morning without vocalizing and sing Wagner or Schubert. And then again, I realized that God had given me this very unusual talent for which I still thank him constantly for the talent of singing that he gave to me. And because I know that I shouldn't have been able to sing all that I sang if God hadn't given me this talent. And I also think, I use the word naivety, I was so naive and innocent before, but I think he gave me a gift that I realized not too many years ago, a gift of not to be nervous. I was excited about singing and performing. I love music so much. I almost love symphonic and piano music more than singing. I really do. I listen to this music all the time. Horowitz was a neighbor of mine in New York when I was out there, and I used to listen to recordings of Rubinstein and Glenn Gould playing the Bach, Goldberg variations and all that music. But I just realized that God gave me this talent, a gift of not to be have stage fright. I was kind of like a racehorse, you know, they can't wait for that gate to lift up and they go tearing out of there. But at the same time, the jockey has to hold him back or burn himself out. Therefore, I come to Mr. Kellis again, the one who discovered me. I was offered roles like Scarpia and The Flying Dutchman way before I did them in the early 70s, mid-70s. And Mr. Kellis said, he always called me Simone, Simon in Italian. Simone, he said, I know you have all of the notes, Simon. He said, but you're not ready for those roles to sing a whole role. And he said, even dramatically in the psychological aspect of a horrible villain like Scarpia and all this. And I listened to that man. I waited.
There is another blessing.
That was another. I believe God sent Charles Kellis to the University of Iowa in 1961. He was a young teacher himself. He was 34 years old. I believe God sent him there to find Simon Estes, or I wouldn't be sitting here today. And I worked with him 2 years, and then he got me into Juilliard.
And just I'll insert a little editorial point, but I know that you have been an advocate for arts education in Iowa, and
yes.
This is as great a testament to what it can do as I've ever heard. I mean, this was a music teacher at the University of Iowa.
Charles Kellis, that man, he's 87 years of age. He's turned on the 12th of April. Mr. Kellis has turned 87, and I'll be seeing him next week when I go to New York. But that man, really, without that man, I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you today.
And next week in New York, by the way, you'll be singing what we just heard you sing in Beethoven's Ninth for
Elie Wiesel, yes.
At another Nobel laureate.
Right, yes.
And he's one of many Nobel laureates you have sung for, Nelson Mandela and
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Barack Obama. Yeah, I've been just very blessed.
With all of this, you've also provided a kind of a model of how someone gives back through your work as a philanthropist and humanitarian, and segues into several programs you're doing right now. One of them, an Iowa scholarship program, young artist program, and also the Malaria Project.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you like to start on all of this? How did you start thinking about this kind of work?
I didn't know when I was at the University of Iowa getting introduced to classical music that I was going to be an opera singer and have success with it. And Mr. Kellis, because he gave me free voice lessons, I didn't have money to pay him. And I said, Mr. Kellis, if I ever have a career, I want to pay you. He said, Simone, it's not if, it's when. He said, you will have a career. He said, but I don't want you to pay me any money. He said, I want you to remain humble the way your mother taught you. And so to kind of answer your question, all of that was preparing me. I thought, well, if ever I'm successful, I want to help young people, because I really struggled financially at the University of Iowa. Sometimes I didn't have enough food to eat, slept on a floor without a rug, et cetera, et cetera. I never mentioned that to any of my colleagues when I was at the University of Iowa. Sometimes I had a handful of cereal to eat with water and not milk, but I never told anybody. And all of that was preparing me, and I thank God really blessed me with, I say this with humility, he blessed me with a good heart. And just recently I was speaking with Bishop Trimble, who's a bishop of all the Methodist churches in Iowa or the Midwest. I had a luncheon with him sometime last year, and towards the end of November, beginning of December. And we had this long conversation, and he had never met me before. In fact, I just saw him in Des Moines, had a meeting with him in Des Moines day before yesterday. He said to me, he said, Simon, why do you have, this is a bishop speaking, why do you have so much joy in your heart? And no one had ever asked me that question before. And I thought just for a few seconds, I said, because I don't have any room for hate in my heart. He said, I'm going to remember what you said. But what this prepared me to want to help people. Having grown up very poor, I just thought, if I'm blessed, I want to help. And so I think God led me to establish several scholarship funds, even one in Switzerland, the International Scholarship Fund in Switzerland, where I've helped children in hospitals and all around the world. I've helped thousands of children that most people don't even know about that. And I don't say that for want any praise or glory. I just did it because I wanted to help. And when I was singing for the grand finale concert, the World Cup in South Africa, about 4 years ago or so, whenever that was, for a little over 4 years ago, Bocelli, you know, the blind tenor, he performed. He and I were two main solo artists at the grand finale concert of the World Cup. It was in Johannesburg. Before I went out to sing, the moderator mentioned that 90% of all of the malaria deaths in the world are in Africa, children 5 years of age and under dying because of a mosquito bite. And 1 million children were dying every year. Every 30 seconds, a child's dying. And that really was heavy on my heart. And so about 2 years ago, I decided I wanted to try to help these children. As you may or may not know, I did a big concert at the Hilton Coliseum in December 15th. And I had the biggest high school choir in the state of Iowa. They've ever had over 1,100 and some students from 53 different high schools performed with me. Joseph June to conduct the Des Moines Symphony Youth Orchestra. And we raised over slightly over $100,000 in that concert. And I wrote a check to the United Nations Foundation in Washington, D.C., Nothing But Nets, gave them the whole $100,000 because I want to help save these children's lives in Africa. So right now I'm on a big mission, a cause to help save these children's lives, because all they need is a $5 treated net to sleep under. Mosquito, the moment it touches the net, it dies. It can transmit it to someone else. And there are a lot of people that are doing good things and trying to help. But nonetheless, the World Health Organization still says there are up to 971,000 children are still dying. And 90% of all of the malaria deaths in the world are in sub-Saharan Africa. And so that's something I think that God's called me to do, to try to help save these children's lives. And so I'm working very hard. That one CD, Save the Children, Save Their Lives, and that CD is played. When people buy it, I give $5 to buy a net, but now I'm going to start giving $10. I sell it for $15, so I'm giving $10. That means I can save two children's lives because each net costs $5. So I have a goal between now and I don't know when, maybe the end of this year, before the end of this year, to try to raise $5 million to be able to buy 1 million nets and save 1 million children's lives.
And we're going to play a sample from that CD in a moment. And I do want to say, I did a little reading on this, and there's something like a $200 million funding gap for treated mosquito nets.
Yes.
Which really do save lives. It's a
very nets, awesome. This is the, see, number one, this is preventable. All those, I carry a net around in my car, in the trunk of my car. I show it to people sometimes. You can get sometimes two or three children out of that. And you know, I can understand that the world is still allowing this, almost like a childhood holocaust, that the children are innocent too, like the Jewish people. They were innocent during this time that they were needlessly slaughtered. The world is letting these children die. Well, I have a signed agreement with the United Nations Foundation, nothing but nets. I'm going to provide the nets, and they will distribute the nets, educate the people, make sure the nets are treated, and follow up on it. And I'm doing that because, as I say, there are a lot of people that are trying, but children are still dying. Now, the World Health Organization says every 60 seconds a child is dying. Every 60 seconds. Maybe you and I have been talking, I don't know, maybe 45, 50 minutes. That means between 50 and 100 children have died. And they need nothing but a treated net. So that's my, maybe, the last big mission or goal that the Lord's called me to do is to try to help save these children's lives. And I will give God all the praise and glory if we can do this and get people to help me raise $5 million to buy the nets.
You've made it an educational experience for school children. You've gotten high school children around Iowa involved in this cause of raising money so that they are learning about the philanthropy from doing it. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the CD that I'm selling, Save the Children, Save Their Lives, a lot of high schools have taken, I've taken hundreds to high schools and they're selling it. And what I'm doing too, I'm giving $5. The CD costs $15. I'm giving $5 to the high schools. They can use it for in the music department, which I would prefer, and they say that's okay, or reduce and free meals, whatever, because I didn't realize that there are students in Iowa who are hungry. And then $5 goes to buy a net. And I decided to do that at all the high schools where I'm singing. I'm planning on singing all 99 counties, called Roots and Wings Tour, to help students with scholarships. And I've given now 130 scholarships in the last 3.5 years to students who are going to all the different colleges and universities here in Iowa, and they're studying whatever major they want to do that. And that's, again, because I struggled so when I was at the University of Iowa, as I told you earlier, scrubbing floors, shining shoes, cleaning toilets. I always said I want to try to help young people with their education because it's very expensive today for students to go to college. I don't want them not to be able to go just because they don't have money. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing this Roots and Wings 99 County Tour. I've done 38 or 39 now I've done.
Wow. This. Where are you going next?
Well, the next ones we have, my manager has. We've got about 10 on the books now.
Oh, great.
Between now and within the end of this year. And I can't remember where they all are right now. But
wherever you are as you listen to this,
yes.
Check and see if Simon Estes has come to your county yet. And if not, get in touch with him at SimonEstesFoundation.org. Another question I wanted to ask you about is, I know that early in your career, you avoided roles that would be stereotyped, that would pigeonhole an African-American singer,
mm-hmm.
Corrigan Bess, notably,
mm-hmm.
and Showboat. And eventually you did sing these, but how did that play out in your career?
I knew from very early on because of what had happened to other great singers like William Warfield. Do you know that name, William
yes.
Warfield? He never got to sing opera because he was a black man. They'd only let him sing Joe in Showboat or Porgy and Porgy and Bess. And so I surmise that maybe that's why I shouldn't do those until I'm more established as the classical operatic singer. So I was offered many of those, and I wouldn't sing them in the very beginning. And there's a lot of stories I could tell you about it, but I just didn't do it. And then once I had sung maybe 50, 60 roles in opera, I realized it couldn't hurt me if I sang Porgy. And so the first time I sang Porgy and Bess, I think it was in Zurich. It was in Zurich, Switzerland. That's right. They did a new production there. And then next thing I knew, I sang it at the Metropolitan Opera because the Met had never done Porgy and Bess until Grace Bumbry and I did that new production in the early, mid-'80s. And then I sang it in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and other places, but I couldn't do it. And Showboat, I never did sing Joe, incidentally, in Showboat, but I used to sing Old Man River on my program as an encore also. And, of course, everybody liked it. But then at one point, I wouldn't do it because maybe I'd done Brahms' four serious songs, some Schubert songs, et cetera, et cetera. But the only thing people would talk about afterwards was Simon Estes' Old Man River, which I love. It's a great song. It's got one of the greatest melodies ever written. So as You'll Never Walk Alone or Climb Every Mountain, all of these Broadway musical melodies that were composed by these great American composers and arrangers, those melodies are just as beautiful as Verdi's melodies. But we Americans sometimes are afraid to sing them because we think, oh, well, it's not Verdi, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein, or it's Jerome Kearns, and that's not Richard Wagner. But I sing those songs now because I've done everything so they can't put me in a box and stereotype me and find it. There are no greater melodies than for a bass to sing Old Man River.
And it is on the Save the Children CD. We'll tell you more about how to get that in a moment. But first, here it is. were sung incomparably by Simon Estes, and it's one of the cuts on Save the Children, Save Their Lives, a CD, the proceeds of which will go to funding the purchase of treated malaria nets, which literally saves lives of children in Africa. And it can be yours. You just go online to www.simonestesfoundation.org. And I will be putting a link onto my page on Iowa Public Radio as well. Very, very worthy cause, and a lot of wonderful music in your life when you get the CD as well. Simon Estes, that was just one of the great performances I've heard of that.
Thank you very much.
And I can tell as you gave it just the right amount of dramatization, as if you had performed the role on stage, but you hadn't. Simon Estes, it's just been an incredible honor and treat to have you here sharing all of these stories and wisdom with us. And I could really go on all afternoon, but I know you have things you need to get to. But I hope we will be able to get you back sometimes too.
I would be humbled and honored to come back. It's been wonderful speaking with you, and you're so knowledgeable about music. And I can tell you have a beautiful heart because you appreciate this great music. I still, to this day, I pray and I thank God that he gave talent to men. Unfortunately, we're all men back in those days, but whether it be Verdi, Brahms, Mozart, Wagner, Puccini, Tchaikovsky, all those great composers, Mozart, Bach, those talents really came from God. Because can you imagine, they started composing music when they're 5 and 6 and 7 years of age? They hadn't gone to Juilliard School of Music or any other conservatory. They just had this talent. And I feel so humbled and so blessed to think I have been able to sing that great music with these great conductors and orchestras and colleagues.
Well, we're going to hear one last sample of your singing with one of the great conductors, Carlo Maria Giulini. I know that you and I spoke about him right before we started this interview this afternoon. He was the one conducting the Beethoven Ninth. Just tell us a little bit about him, and then in a moment we'll be back to hear the section from the Mozart Requiem with your singing.
As I said, I've sung with about 90 conductors around the world, and there's probably a few that I've even forgotten. But one of the greatest was Giulini. This man was incredibly gifted with a beautiful heart to put his heart and soul into the music, as well as the intellectual, educational aspect of the cerebral or the brain part of it. He made a wonderful combination of bringing both into music, because music, It's like poetry, it's like a message, and a symphony has all these different movements to it. But Giulini was one of my very, very, very favorite conductors, because he conducted not only from his brain, but from his heart and soul. And when I did the Beethoven Miso Solemnis with him, the Verdi Requiem, the Mozart Requiem, which you're going to play, it was almost like going to church when you performed with Giulini. And he had a beautiful soul, a beautiful heart. He was a conductor that was not didn't have a temper, and never creating temper tantrums. He was always very calm and loved music. And very few conductors would do what Giulini always did. He would say to a singer, "Are you comfortable with this tempo?" Or he would ask us. Most conductors, you just have to do exactly what they say. Not Giulini. He was a very empathetic and sympathetic conductor with a beautiful heart and a beautiful soul.
It seems like you and him were sort of soulmates, really.
Yes.
And we'll hear Mozart, the Tuba Mirum from his Requiem, with Giulini conducting and Simon Estes singing in just a moment. But first, I want to say thank you to Simon Estes. Dr. Estes, thank you so much for coming in. It's just been a great delight for all of us and a great honor. And I hope we will have you back.
I'd be honored to come back and be with your program.